Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Jeff Scherer is back with a new book on the Civil War, this one the beginning of a trilogy of books that looks at the war's westernmost battles. The book, A Blaze of Glory, looks at the Battle of Shiloh in Tennessee, which claimed nearly 24,000 lives and featured the leadership of Ulysses S. Grant of the North. As he does in his other bestsellers, Jeff Scherer mixes the voices of leaders such as Grant, Johnston, and Sherman with the voices of ordinary soldiers. It's proved to be a potent approach, as Jeff Scherer has written acclaimed historical novels on the American Revolution, World War I and II, and the Mexican-American War. His work includes two books that bookend his late father's Pulitzer Prize winner, The Killer Angels. Those books were Gods and Generals and The Last Full Measure, both of which spent weeks on the bestseller list. He speaks in town at 7 p.m. tonight at Unity Temple on the Plaza, and he's here with me right now. And Jeff Scherer, so good to have you.
Thank you.
Welcome
pleasure to
Kansas
be here.
City. Yeah. Well, your new book is the first of three that will look at the westernmost battles of the Civil War. Why did you want to go west with your new storytelling here?
Well, I can't tell you how many letters I've received from people in Tennessee and Mississippi who've said, we're sort of tired of hearing about Robert E. Lee in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's an awful lot of stuff that happens west of the Appalachian Mountains.
And they'd be right.
That nobody ever talks about. And
yeah.
So I'd been to Shiloh. I'd been to Vicksburg. I did a nonfiction book on the Civil War battlefields, places I thought every American should visit. Those were two of them. So I was familiar with the ground. And as my father learned walking the battlefield at Gettysburg, when you see a story, a good story, that's something worth telling.
Tell us about the battlefield at Shiloh. How much today is it like what it was 150 years ago?
Shiloh is a wonderful place to visit because it is 98% original.
Really?
It is in a place where really nobody wants to live. I mean, all due respects to the people who do live there. But it's farm country. It's on the Tennessee River. But it is, I mean, the closest city is Memphis, which is about a 2.5-hour drive. So it's really not under any threat of development. And so it is the way it was in 1862. And you can really get a feel for the battle.
Yes. Well, when you walk those fields, what do you pick up, Jeff?
Well, first of all, as with most national military parks, which it is, the Park Service runs it, you know, there are cannons, there are monuments. So you can get a feel for who is where and so forth. And that adds to the experience. But when you come up, you're in a field and you realize an entire regiment of Union soldiers is in this field with their tents pitched and they're doing drills every day and this kind of thing. And then you look around the field on the far end and it falls away into thick, dense woods and there's no way to see anything. That's where the Confederates came from. And, you know, you think you hear something, the ground, the lay of the land sort of distorts the noise. And all of a sudden, 2,000 or 3,000 people come up this hill and they're in your field and literally in your face. And the shock of that is really what determines what happens at Shiloh for about the first day.
So to be there, you got to see it to really understand what happened.
Well, that's important for me. I mean, as the storyteller, I mean, it's really an advantage to walk the ground in every story I tell. And Shiloh definitely is like that because once you are down in the—and I've done this—you go crawl down into some ravine and it's vines and thickets and your thorns and all of this stuff, and you realize— guys marched through this stuff. Guys surged through this stuff. A lot of times they got trapped down in these ravines, and it was a shooting match. Guys up on the hill above them would just pick them apart. All of that adds to the experience. And, of course, the river, the Tennessee River right there, that was the great barrier. Guys with their backs to the river, there's no other place to go. And that's a pretty obvious thing to see.
You know, one of your interests is sort of the preservation of these historic battlefields. What kind of shape are the American Civil War battlefields today? How much under threat are they?
Well, it's a mixed bag. I mean, you've mm-hmm. got places like Shiloh, which are virtually perfect, and places like Antietam, and of course Gettysburg is the pinnacle. But then there are other places where there's a great deal of threat. I mean, I can name a long list, but Franklin, Tennessee is a really good example. The battlefield is virtually non-existent. Now, I'm on the board of Civil War Trust. We are the largest land. Our motto is we buy dirt. That's what we do, is try to preserve as much land as we can. We work with the Park Service, with private people, it's all private dollars. And the idea is to take some of this land, because once it's gone, it's gone. I mean, you can't replace it. And places like Franklin, Tennessee, or Fredericksburg, or anything you can preserve, we can buy a 100-acre tract or a 500-acre tract that will forever be preserved so that your kids, my kids, grandkids can get the history, can get the story by walking this same ground.
But we're in danger of losing some of those battlefields, it sounds like.
Well, of course. And I mean, I'm not anti-development or anything like that. I understand cities grow. The city of Fredericksburg grew up to fill the Union part of that battlefield. Well, you can't fault the city of Fredericksburg. But nowadays, the awareness has risen a great deal. And I think when people are realized that in their own backyard, they have a piece of hallowed ground, they have something that needs to be preserved, suddenly it's a little less important to have that strip mall.
Yeah.
And I think that's a kind of a consciousness that we're trying to raise.
Historical novelist Jeff Shera is our guest. You know, you're writing 3 books in 3 years, and you're nodding your head and closing your eyes at the same time. That's a load.
It's a load. It's determined by the calendar. This is the sesquicentennial of the Civil War, the 150th anniversary. The idea is to do this trilogy where each book comes out during the anniversary year of that event. So Shiloh was 1862, 2012. Next year will be Vicksburg, again, same thing, 1863.
Yeah.
And the third book of the trilogy will follow Sherman through Atlanta, through the March to the Sea, and then the end of the war with Sherman in the Carolinas. And I just have to say, I love the piece of trivia. People assume the Civil War ends at Appomattox, April 9th, 1865, when Lee surrenders to Grant.
That's right.
In fact, it does not. I mean, it keeps going. Joe Johnston in North Carolina does not surrender to Sherman until April 26th, which is 10 days after Lincoln's assassination, 2.5 weeks after Lee's surrender. The war keeps going, and that's something a lot of people don't realize.
You know, what do you make of the fact that this country remains as deeply interested in the Civil War as it does today, Jeff? I mean, around here, it's a hot topic. People still talk it up. Books still sell. What do you make of it?
Well, it's our war. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a uniquely, civil wars are certainly not unique. I mean, they're going on today. But in fact, the American Civil War, if you think about it, it was fought over ideas. I mean, this country was founded over ideas. It wasn't formed over a religion, over boundaries. It was formed over a concept. Well, those concepts varied from different parts of the country. And so it's a very personal war. I mean, in researching Vicksburg, for example, right now, I mean, you've got guys from Missouri, up on the Confederate side, up behind the works, and then you've got guys from Missouri on the Union side trying to climb up and kill them. At the end of the day, they're talking to each other. It's like, oh, hi. Oh, you're my neighbor. You know, there's a lot of this stuff. It is a very personal experience for an enormous number of people. And because we have ancestry, because we're talking about our great-great-grandfathers here, it does resonate. And, of course, it's almost cliche, but it's probably accurate to say it resonates a little more strongly in the South. I grew up I'm from New Jersey, but I grew up in the South, in North Florida, and I hear it all the time. And everywhere I've traveled, whether it's Atlanta, Nashville, Memphis, Jackson, Mississippi, it's a presence, and I don't think that'll change.
Now, you take a lot of pride in the research you do for your books, which have done so very well, which is probably one reason why they do. Are you still learning things about the war? Are there still new things coming out about it that we didn't know 10, 20 years ago?
Oh, I hope so. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a big part of my research. I mean, my research, just sort of by definition, is all original source material, diaries, memoirs, collections of letters. My job is to take you back with me to the 1860s and tell you that story the way those people would tell it themselves. So modern biography, modern history, with all due respect to modern historians, that really doesn't help me. I have to hear the voices of the characters. So that research is enormous fun because I will run into voices. I mean, obviously, they're the big players, the Shermans, the Grants, the Robert E. Lees. But the other, it's the grunt, the guy in the field with the holding the bayonet in his hand. Those are the fascinating stories because that's what happened. Those guys were there. They lived it. And it's not all blood and guts. It's not about, killing necessarily. And I hope people understand, I don't just write war stories. I'm described as a war writer.
These are character-driven stories,
exactly.
Aren't they?
They're not event-driven. And I have to tell you, I'm very gratified by the number of women, the number of young people that come to my book events because they realize, someone buys a book for their father for Father's Day, assuming he's going to like the book. And then, the mother reads the book and says, well, this is a good story. That's the best compliment I can hear.
Yeah. What intrigued you about the Battle of Shiloh? Or maybe the question is, what's not to intrigue by a battle that, has Ulysses S. Grant and gunboats and swamps and all kinds of strategy. But what grabs you about it?
Well, the way history changed, the enormous what if. I mean, Civil War people love what ifs. I mean, there's loads of them. You get in big debates with these guys all the time.
Every battle seems to have it.
Oh,
right?
Absolutely. But there's a big one at Shiloh. And the big one is the death of Albert Sidney Johnston, the Confederate commander. His death changes the history of the war. A lot of people have never heard of this guy. I mean, I run into that everywhere I go.
Why did it change the course of the war?
Well, first of all, he was winning. At the time of his death on April 6th, he was winning the battle. Had they won the battle,
the Confederates,
Confederates, you never would have heard of Ulysses Grant because it would have been the end of Grant's career, the 18th president of the United States. Beyond that, by Johnston going down, you deprived the South of, first of all, their highest ranking field commander. Johnston outranked Robert E. Lee. And so when Lee gets appointed command of the Army of Northern Virginia in mid-1862, it's entirely likely that Jefferson Davis would have appointed Johnston instead, and we never would have heard of Robert E. Lee. So you take these things and you kind of weave them together, and it's a fascinating story.
How did Johnston die?
It's one of those amazing tragedies. The man is one of a dying breed of generals who leads from the front. Generals quickly learn that's a really bad idea after the Civil War. But Johnston is in the midst of the chaos, the mess. There's stuff going on all around him. His horse is wounded four times. He's got musket balls passing through his clothing. And he gets nicked on the back of his right knee with, and we don't know what it was, a spent shell, a little piece of shrapnel. He doesn't even feel it. It's like a bee sting. He ignores it. What it does is it nicks the artery behind his right kneecap, and he bleeds to death into his boot. So he doesn't even know he's wounded until he realizes his boot is full of blood. And then, of course, he begins to waver as he gets weaker. He's taken down off his horse by his staff. And by the time they even find the wound, he's dead.
Quite a story.
And there's a postscript. Everyone realizes a simple tourniquet would have saved his life. He had one in his pocket.
Ah, man. Hey, how did the North turn the battle? What happened?
Well, first of all, the South, the Confederates were so successful on April 6th, they drove the Union forces out of their own camps. So the Confederates are in the Union camps. Well, you know, there's food, there's liquor, there's supplies, things that the Confederates don't have. So it begins to be a little bit of sort of an orgy of consumption. I mean, they just start grabbing stuff. The battle sort of breaks down. Also, they're exhausted by the end of the day. You know, they're in motion all day. The fighting has been just horrific. Some of the Union forces that don't run stand toe-to-toe with these guys, and they duke it out all day long, and that's why the casualty count is so enormous. But at the end of the day, General Beauregard, who takes over from Johnston at the time of Johnston's death, he's the second in command, and Beauregard orders the battle to stop on April 6th with an hour of daylight left, which is possibly one of the largest mistakes. That's another what if.
Because they had the momentum.
They had the momentum. Beauregard doesn't know this. He's in the back. He has no idea that they're actually winning the day. He's afraid, well, we're a little too spread out. We're getting a lot of stragglers. And he calls a halt to the fighting. And so they withdraw away from the Union position. Well, in the meantime, Grant is being reinforced by a great deal more troops under another Union general, Don Carlos Buell, who's ferrying his people across the Tennessee River. All night long, the Union army is getting stronger and stronger. Grant's lines are now compacted in a much smaller area. He's got artillery. And so the next morning, they plan a counterattack. Well, the Confederates are scattered all over the woods. It pours rain all night. So everybody's powder's wet. The Confederates have no cover. So they're, you know, soaking wet and miserable. And the officers can't find their own men. It's complete disorganization. Mm-hmm. So when the Union Army counterattacks, the fight goes exactly the other way. It is a Union day, and the Confederates are eventually driven right off of the field.
Boy, that's amazing. You know, like so many battles, Jeff, there was a huge cost of life, nearly 24,000 dead. How does that compare to other major Civil War battles?
Well, the first major battle of the war is at Manassas, Bull Run in Virginia, Northern Virginia. And then, you know, summer of 1861, it is considered at the time horrific. A lot of people for the first time realize, hey, this is actually going to be a war. I mean, we're actually killing each other here. Well, at Manassas, there are approximately 4,000 to 5,000 casualties, which is enormous. I mean, that's a horrible thing. At Shiloh, there are five times that many. The reason Shiloh doesn't have the impact, if you think about where it is, Manassas is right between Washington and Richmond, which are the big media centers. So you have reporters, photographs. I am not aware, and I would love for somebody to show me one, there is not a single existing photograph of the Shiloh battlefield right after the battle.
Wow.
Why? There were no photographers there.
It's in the middle of nowhere.
It's in the middle of nowhere. Newspaper reporters are very scarce. So people in the East, particularly in the Northeast, really don't even know what happened there. They get the battle reports, and then slowly it begins to, you know, the news gets out. There were 24,000 casualties there. People are shocked by that.
And Gettysburg is what? More than twice that.
50,000.
Yeah,
right? Yeah. But Gettysburg takes place over 3 days. Shiloh takes place really about a day and a half.
Yeah. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here for Jeff Shera. Our email address, UpToDate at KCUR.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page or tweet us at KCUR UpToDate. Mike from Lawrence. Mike, you're on the program. Good morning.
Thanks for taking my call. I've been to Shiloh twice, and I grew up in the Red River Theater to the west of Vicksburg on the Louisiana side. And when we visited it, I found out there was an Indian mound right in the middle of the battlefield, right there by the river. And I didn't know if anybody else had known about that. I had people on both sides of the Union and Confederacy that fought, and the ones that fought on the Confederacy were Indian. But I was just curious, have you ever heard anything about that Indian mound being in the middle of that battlefield?
It's in the book. There's a very important role that those Indian mounds, which, as you say, are right on the Tennessee River, there's a role that they play during the evening between the 6th and the 7th, the first and second day, when Nathan Bedford Forrest goes to those Indian mounds in the middle of the night, gets up on them, and uses them as a vantage point to scout the Union position. And so Forrest is the man who realizes that the Union troops are being reinforced. He sees the transport boats going back and forth across the river. So, yes, and those Indian mounds, as you say, they're there today. It's a part of the Park Service facility there. It's a beautiful area, and I strongly recommend people visit that.
I also grew up at Jonesville, Louisiana, and they had a humongous ceremonial mound that they tore down there in the 1930s that they put cannons on because it was on the Ouachita River going into the Red River. And I remember reading about the Civil War stuff there, but I'll let y'all get.
Yeah, thank you, Mike. You know, you tell this story, Jeff, through the eyes of a couple of grunts, Confederate Cavalry Lieutenant James Seeley, and from the North, Private Fritz Dutchie Bauer of the 16th Wisconsin Regiment. How did you come up with these guys? These are characters.
They're characters. Every time I do, I mean, obviously the historical, the big names, I mean, I have memoirs and so forth, people we know, Grant, Sherman, and so forth. The guys out front, I'll start with a real person. I've got a memoir or a diary. And I will take other experiences from other characters and sort of incorporate them into this same individual. I'll change the name, but the character might be sort of semi-fictitious, but everything that happens to him is absolutely real. I mean, I don't make that stuff up. It's all in the diaries, and some of it's pretty grisly, some of it's amazing. They're heroic, but it's all true.
Yeah, how about the dialogue involving the historical figures like Grant and Lee, for example?
Well, that's my job. That's why, you know, by definition, these books are novels. They have to be called novels because of the dialogue and because you're in the heads of the characters. We may have Grant's memoir, Sherman's memoir, but, you know, we know a conversation took place or a meeting take place on such and such a day. We know what the outcome was, but we will never know what they actually said word for word. That's my job. And, I'm really proud of the fact that I get critics. Yeah, my books are criticized just like anybody else's. But one thing I've never heard from a critic is, you know, Ulysses Grant never would have said that. I mean, I'm really proud of that.
Yeah. You know, and writing wasn't even in the picture for you as an occupation when you were a young man. Well, what were you doing years ago?
Well, I started out as a dealer in rare coins and precious metals. I had a retail store in Tampa, Florida for 20 years. My father was a writer all his life, and growing up in the house of a writer, people assume, oh, you must have wanted to, you know, follow in your father's footsteps. Oh, no. His career was, for the most part, pretty negative. My mother worked for the state of Florida for 37 years to pay the bills because my father could never pay the bills from his writing. I had no interest in following in those footsteps at all. I mean, I became the opposite. I became a businessman.
Yeah, your father did have some bad luck. I mean, it seemed like so much of the success that came to him happened too late.
Well, I mean, the Killer Angels wins the Pulitzer Prize in 1975.
Right.
Any writer who wins a Pulitzer Prize has the right to believe his ship has come in.
And he never saw that coming, by the way. That came completely out of the blue, didn't it?
Think about 1975, end of the Vietnam War. If there's anything out of fashion in this country, it's a book about generals. And yet, the Killer Angels wins the Pulitzer Prize. Now, what was disappointing to him is nothing happened. The Killer Angels does not become a commercial success. He doesn't get the option in New York and in the publishing industry to write anything he wants to. It's just it comes and goes, and that's the end of it.
Because it wasn't in fashion? Is that what?
Exactly right.
Yeah.
And 13 years later, he dies of his second heart attack. He's only 59 years old. 5 years after that, the movie Gettysburg comes out based on his book. The film makes his book a number one bestseller 19 years after it was published and 5 years after his death.
How hard was that for you, Jeff?
Well, I mean, first of all, when Ted Turner's people came to me and said, you know, Ted's success with the film Gettysburg, he's all excited, he wants to make more Civil War movies. You know, they said, why don't you take your father's book, go in both directions, same characters, and tell more of the story so that Ted can make movies. It was always about film. I had never written anything before. I mean, that's not exaggeration. I mean, I was not a writer. And the idea that people asked me, weren't you afraid? I mean, how did you know how to do this? I had no idea, but there were no expectations. The idea is I'll put a story together using my father's kinds of research, work on a book called Gods and Generals, the prequel to The Killer Angels. And if it's lousy, it'll go in the trash. I mean, nobody will ever see it. Well, I'm representing my father's estate in New York. Random House now has this number one bestseller in The Killer Angels. And I'm talking to them, and they're saying, what is this that you're doing? I said, well, I'm working on the prequel to my father's book. They said, well, you ought to send us the manuscript. Okay, I'll send you the manuscript. The phone call I got was, we don't care if it's a movie. We like the book. We think you're a writer. Here's a contract. That changed my whole life. I mean, I had, believe me, when Gods and Generals comes out, it debuts on the bestseller list. Now, I'm under no illusions that the great American author has arrived. I mean, I know full well people were cutting me slack. They wanted more of my father's book. And, I mean, I got cut enormous slack all over the country by critics everywhere. 15 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list and a 59-city book signing tour. I mean, I'm awestruck by this. My whole life is different now, and I realize I'm walking in enormous footsteps.
Well, what made you think you could pull together a book to begin with as someone who had spent 20 years in the rare coin business?
Well, what I've said, you know, I wanted to try. That's really all it was ever about. I mean, there's a lot of arrogance in assuming you can write a book. And I hear a lot of that, and I recognize it completely. I didn't know I could write a book. I had no idea. And then, of course, second, I didn't know I could sell a book. And third, I didn't know people would want to read it. And then here, 12 books later, it's my career. I mean, believe me, no one is more surprised by this than I am.
Well, tell us about writing that first book. How much of a struggle was it?
I have to tell you, and maybe every writer can relate to this, looking, in my case, at a blank computer screen, I realized the hardest single thing to do is the first line of the book. I mean, how do you start? I mean, I remember looking at the blank screen and laughing. It's like, what in the world are you doing? And then the first line comes, and then it flows. And I mean, I can remember, you know, I would write whatever, 10 or 12 pages a day. I go back the next morning and reread it, and there would be stuff there that I didn't remember writing. And when that happened, I mean, to me, that's the magic. And I hate to use that word, but it's part of that process. It's a wonderful thing.
So you didn't struggle with that first book, Gods and Generals?
It took me 15 months of research because I knew the research. I knew the kinds of things my father had done. And then 8 months to write the manuscript. And it was fun. I mean, I enjoyed it. Now, whether it was a struggle, I mean, we cut a lot of what was in that first manuscript. The editor, you know, that I was introduced to in New York. Again, I'd never been through this process. I never sat down with an editor before. And we went through it and we cut a lot. And I took his word. I never argued. My father would fight every editor he ever had. But no, I mean, I recognize, okay, this guy's a professional. He's telling me this chapter needs to go away or needs to be changed. Okay, we'll do that. And so it was a very cooperative process. And at the end of the day, it worked. And again, nobody's more surprised by this than I am.
But the writing, it sounds like, came fairly naturally to you. There must have been something passed on father to son.
I hope so. I mean, I really hope that's the reason, because I don't have a better answer for it.
Yeah. Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our very good conversation here with Jeff Shera. His new book, A Blaze of Glory, looks at the Battle of Shiloh. We'll take your questions at 816-235-2888. We'll talk about Jeff Shera's own breakdown in his relationship with his dad. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's appointment with the book doctors, you'll find their recommendations and all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, a tireless promoter of the Kansas City jazz scene and a darn good vocalist, too, David Bassey, joins us. Also, we'll find out why people are hanging out in hammocks outside of Bartle Hall. That's tomorrow on the show. This hour, we're visiting with Jeff Shera about his new book, A Blaze of Glory, that looks at the Battle of Shiloh. He speaks tonight on the Country Club Plaza at 7 o'clock with our friends from Rainy Day Books sponsoring that as usual. To reserve a seat, call Rainy Day Books in Fairway, 913-384-3126. Again, Jeff Shera speaks tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Country Club Plaza. Our phone number here again, 816-235-2888. Our email address, UpToDate at KCUR.org. You know, things in your family got really interesting back in the early 80s, Jeff. Your mom and dad got divorced, and he cut his connections to you as well. How surprised were you by that, and how did that happen?
It evolved over time. To answer your question, I was not surprised at all. Mm-hmm. He had a motorcycle accident right about the time The Killer Angels was completed in the mid-70s, and it damaged his brain pretty badly. He was in a coma for about a month. It was bad news, and he was in Italy at the time, It changed him. It changed his writing. I remember he would stare at the typewriter for hours at a time and nothing would come out, which to a writer who had been as prolific as he was, he published 70 short stories and 4 novels, and suddenly he lost it. He lost the ability. Well, that really made him an angry, bitter, disappointed man. He loved writing more than anything else, and suddenly he couldn't do it. And as even though heart disease is what killed him, he was a heavy, heavy smoker. I think his loss of writing ability probably hastened that as well.
He was a different man, it sounds like.
Very definitely. And it wasn't just, he didn't just isolate me from his life. He isolated his own brother. He isolated his father. I mean, he really cut himself off from the world. And then, of course, isolated himself from my mother. It was a sickness. I mean, it mm-hmm. most definitely was clinical depression and something that he struggled with for the last few years of his life.
Did you ever reconcile before he passed?
No, we didn't. And that's, in a way, I mean, I don't want to get all psychological here and psychobabble and so forth, but the books I've written, in a way, that's the reconciliation. I mean, these should be his books. I mean, he should have lived to write Gods and Generals. Ted Turner would have gone to him and said, let's continue the story. He earned that right. And here I am, stepping into those shoes. And for a long time, I had a very difficult time standing up in front of an audience, holding a copy of my book in the air and say, hey, look what I did. This was my father's work. This is the work he earned it. I mean, he earned the right to get the accolades.
How long did it take you to get past that?
About 4 books. When I did my first book on the American Revolution, interesting thing happened at Random House. They put out this press kit with every book I write, and they send it to people like you and newspaper reporters all over the country. And in the press kit for Rise to Rebellion, for the first of the Rev War books, there was no mention of my father's name. And I said, hey, wait a minute, whoa, you forgot something here. No. They said, no, this is about your career, not his. I had to think about that. I wasn't really comfortable with that. And then also a very good friend of mine in Los Angeles, I'd done a talk at a bookstore. And I talk a lot about my father. And this guy went to dinner afterwards and he says to me, you know, I'm kind of tired of hearing about Michael Schara. I really want to hear about you.
Hmm.
I mean, that was a little bit of a wake-up call. Somebody then said to me at a book signing with the Rev War books, well, now you're out from under your father's shadow. Mm-hmm. And I never really took it as a shadow in the first place, but I realized maybe I'm finding my own voice. You know, I'm not doing stuff attached to the Killer Angels anymore. I'm doing stories on my own. That was a real difference.
Your focus has been almost solely on war. How come?
Well, you know, again, the idea of labeling me as a war writer, it really kind of bothers me because that's not really what does this. It's the people. If you consider, I mean, if you want to ask the ordinary person to rise to the occasion, what situation are you going to put that person in where he's going to face the greatest test? War. You know, how many times, and I love this, I've done this in World War II, I've done it World War I, all the way through these stories, the guys with the big mouth, the guys in training camp who just can't wait to go, you know, stick a knife in Hitler and that kind of stuff, those are the guys on the battlefield you never hear from again. Mm-hmm. It's that quiet kid that suddenly, you know, the captain is killed, the lieutenant is killed, this kid stands up and takes command of the company, and nobody expects that. Those are the stories that bring me in, the stories and the leaders, people like Ulysses Grant and Sherman. And now that I'm working on Vicksburg, people like John Pemberton, the Confederate commander who surrenders Vicksburg. They're interesting. They're three-dimensional characters. That's fun to write.
Now, your family took a trip to Gettysburg back, in the 70s, that sort of spurred your father to write Killer Angels. Do you recall that trip?
Actually, it was in the 60s. It was in 1964. I was 12 years old. We go to Gettysburg. We're tourists. A lot of people assume my father went there, first of all, that he had a history background. He didn't. He was teaching creative writing. And then also that we went there with some kind of agenda to research. No, we were just like most people that visit there today. We were tourists. You know, we have photographs of me climbing all over cannons because that's what 12-year-olds do. But my father, something happened to him. In walking that ground, he knew a good story when he saw one. And he started learning about people like Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain.
Wow.
He started learning about Pickett's Charge and Louis Armistead and Winfield Hancock and these fabulous characters. And he began to identify with Chamberlain. He began to identify with James Longstreet. And he knew a good story when he saw one. It started an obsession. It took him 7 years to write The Killer Angels. The research back in those days was very difficult compared to today.
Online research.
Exactly. A huge luxury I have is the internet, and my father didn't have that. But, I mean, that's all there was to it. The lesson for me in going to Gettysburg was walk the ground. In every story I've done, with one singular exception, which is the World War II story that takes place in Libya, I've walked the ground. I mean, I've gone to these places. It really is the most important part of the research.
And we were talking, you know, I went to Gettysburg a few years ago with my family just after reading Killer Angels. And, you know, what struck me about it was it seemed so familiar to me after reading the book. But then secondly, you know, standing on top of the hill where Pickett's Charge took place, and as I mentioned to you, you're standing up on top of the hill where the North was standing, looking down across that long expanse of ground where Robert E. Lee sent his troops up that hill. And I was thinking to myself, you know, I know Robert E. Lee is revered as a general, but he made a huge mistake that day because that was not the way to go about winning that battle.
Oh, very definitely.
Even I could tell that.
I mean, there's so much debate about that and so many, you know, why? I mean, that's the bit. Why did he do that?
Yeah. Longstreet didn't want him to do it.
Nope. And of course, for years afterward, Longstreet is the scapegoat, and it's speculated that Longstreet delayed on purpose and all of this kind of stuff. But my father really goes into that quite a bit in The Killer Angels. But I think up until that point, one of the things to consider, first of all, Lee's religiosity, which today to many people seems very old-fashioned and very out of date, that was a powerful force for him. I mean, Robert E. Lee believed that he was in God's hands and that God would decide the day. And of course, people like Longstreet, who's a little more of a cynic, you know, well, God's not carrying the bayonet, you know, and God's not, you know, God's also up there with those guys, you know, looking down on us. The other thing, up until that point, Lee had Stonewall Jackson. He didn't have him at Gettysburg. Jackson by that time was dead, and Jackson's audacity carried the day in battle after battle. Lee knew that, and I think Lee had faith that his army would do it again, and of course, the result was absolute disaster.
Yeah, they came close at a couple points, but...
Well, it was never really in doubt. Yes, the Confederates did cross, step over the Union works in a couple of places, but the Union strength there was far too great. By the time the Confederates, it's a mile of open ground, and the last half of it's uphill.
Yeah.
By the time they get there, they've got nothing left. It's inevitable.
Jeff Scher is our guest. Let's go to some phone calls here, 816-235-2888. Let's go to Paul from Overland Park. Paul, good morning.
Hi. A little story. The early 80s, 1982, 83, I was in Huntsville, Alabama with my family and my wife, child, and mother-in-law, and driving back to Kansas City. I took Route 72, which skirts across the northern part of Mississippi, and I was speeding, and I think it was state police officers stopped me. I'm not sure now, but at any rate, while he was filling out the ticket to make conversation, I asked him, where how to get to Shiloh, because I knew Shiloh was nearby and so forth, and this fellow told me never heard of it, and I wondered whether that could possibly have been personal ignorance or just the fact that he wasn't going to tell this Yankee where Shiloh was.
I suspect it was the latter. I don't think anybody in northern Mississippi has not heard of Shiloh, especially a police officer, law enforcement officer. I think he knew exactly where it was, but yeah, I think the second part of your question is right.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks,
appreciate
Paul.
The answer.
Let's go to Matt from Baldwin City. Matt, good morning.
Well, hello. What an interesting discussion this is.
Good.
I was curious about what the author thinks about the nature of revisionist history. And my question is kind of spurred by something I recently read about, federal public tax dollars being used to reconstruct Jefferson Davis's final home in Mississippi, and that the gift shop sells copies of Little Black Sambo, among other, illustrious tomes. And it seems like this speaks to the issue it seems like the subject of the Civil War is rife with revisionist history.
Oh, I completely agree, and I despise it. First of all, I think what you're referring to about the Jefferson Davis gift shop, that's not true. It sounds good, but that's the kind – and I have big arguments with historians and biographers about this stuff. A biographer will tell you that his job is to write a biography of someone, be accurate to the facts, tell the story of the guy's life. In fact, every biographer, every historian is writing for an audience that's in his time, so that in the 70s, for example, which was a very cynical time, you have all these books coming out about Robert E. Lee. Well, let's take another look at this guy, and he wasn't that great a general, that kind of stuff. So every and again, historians hate it when I say this, but a historian or a biographer is writing to an audience that, is going to appreciate his work, and that audience has their own political views. And, today we're a very polarized society.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very easy to get a book published today that says, well, Lincoln was, not this, he wasn't that. There are books out right now that Winston Churchill was responsible for World War II, and, that he was really the bad guy. This stuff drives me crazy. First of all, I do not do that. My job is not to write. If you hear anything modern or if you hear my voice in any of my books, then I'm a lousy writer. My job is to take you away from today, to take you back to the era of these characters and tell you their story the way they would tell it, not the way, the modern audience would like to read it.
Hmm.
Well, keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Matt, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, if you had to pick one general for one battle on one day from the Civil War, who do you pick?
Well, you're putting me on the spot there because there's all kinds of examples. I think, and this is going to be a problem when I write the third book of this trilogy, I was in Atlanta talking about this guy named Sherman. It didn't go over especially well.
I
always have to remember where I am, when I'm talking to the audience. And I was talking all about Sherman, and I got this growl from the audience. But in fact, if you look at what Sherman accomplished – And it's not just brutality and savagery. And I had some guy say to me, oh, Sherman was a terrorist. Like, no, 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 no. What Sherman was, this was a man who understood war. He understood the completeness of war. If you're going to win, you have to defeat the enemy. Who's the enemy? All of them. And I mean, that, you know, it was up until that time, war was very chivalrous and it was a gentleman's arrangement and all of this stuff. Sherman understands, no, it's not. It's about killing people. It's about burning things. It's about making the other side feel enough pain that they'll want to quit. Sherman understands that enough, and that was a radical concept in the early 1860s. Sherman actually convinces Grant of this, and Grant becomes the adapts the same kind of philosophy, that if we're going to win this war, it's not just capture Richmond. It's not a game of capture the flag. It's destroy Lee's army. That's how you win a war.
Were you tempted to write a book about Kansas and Missouri?
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I get letters all the time. One of the callers earlier mentioned the Red River campaign, you know, Texas and Oklahoma. I mean, very definitely. I mean, it's been done. I would say one thing, and we were talking about this earlier. If you're interested in this part of the country and what happened here, go see a movie called Ride with the Devil.
Great film. You can rent it.
It's on Netflix. I mean, this is an easy movie to find. It is the story of bloody Kansas and what happens in this part of the country. I think it's the most accurate Civil War film ever made.
You know, you once said, Jeff, if there's a nonfiction thing I'm ever going to write, it will be the story of me and my father. You going to do it someday?
Someday. There are some personal reasons why I don't do it now, and it's probably not appropriate to talk about it here, but it's too soon. My mother is alive and well in Tallahassee, and she's 84 years old, and of course she can't hear this, so she doesn't know I'm telling her age. But there are some things that I would write that probably I would not want her to read.
Yeah.
And so for the time, I mean, I have a publisher who's kind of happy with what I'm doing, and they're very much of a philosophy, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah.
So for now, I'll keep doing what I'm doing.
Well, Jeff, it's been a pleasure to have you. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Jeff Scherer's new book is titled A Blaze of Glory. You can hear him tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the plaza. To reserve a seat, call Renee Day Books in Fairway, 913-384-3126.